When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Just before independence, so it's actually 60 years ago, in 1963, in August 1963, there were a lot of these farmers, you know, leathery old jug-eared men with, you know, tanned faces and white necks underneath. Who thought, what's going to happen now? The Africans are going to take, it's going to black government, self-rule. What's going to happen to us? And Jomo Kenyatta, who'd been in jail, seen as this great leader of Mau Mau, came to talk to this meeting of settlers at Nakuru. And Kenyatta comes out and he says, look, we're all children of the soil. You and me, we're both farmers, okay? And we love this land. And then he said, look, there's one thing we can do for each other. We are all humans. None of us are angels. White, brown, or black. We are humans. We are not angels. And we are bound to make mistakes. We've done things wrong. But there's one thing we can do, he said. We can forgive each other. If I have done you wrong, it is for you to forgive me. If you have done me wrong, it is for me to forgive you. Let us forgive each other, he said. And then we can all, white, brown, and black, make this a great nation.
On the 12th of December 1963, a new Kenyan government was formed under Prime Minister Jomo Kenyatta, anti-colonial activist and scourge of the British administration. A year later, he became Kenya's first president, and the new republic has undoubtedly become one of Africa's success stories. But how did it get there? And what are the brutal conflict known as the Kenya Emergency or the Mau Mau Uprising? Joining me is Nicholas Rankin, author of a new book, Trapped in History, Kenya, the Mau Mau and Me, as he explains who were the Mau Mau and why were they so threatening to the colonial administrators. Links are in the show notes, and as ever, please do get in touch if you've got any questions. If you can give me a generous rating, please go ahead. It's so easy to do. Coming up, I've got James I, Checkpoint Charlie, and a chat with the biographer of the great Patrick Lee Fermor. But until then, I'll hand you over to me, Nicholas, Colonial Kenya, and the Mau Mau. Nicholas Rankin, welcome. It's a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you for joining me.
Good to be here.
And I am speaking to you a few reasons, really. Primarily your new book, Trapped in History, Kenya, Mau Mau and Me, which is, I've been reading, fascinating story, really. Your story, the dying embers of the British Empire in Kenya, and then the birth of Kenya right at the end. But also, we did meet previously in another life. And so when I saw your name in the email, I was immediately interested from the email from Faber. But I know that reading the book, I know you, or I've just been reading the acknowledgements, you were originally writing a book on the Basque country and decided that changed. And that's I mentioned that because that's your first, the first book of yours that I read that I absolutely adored, Telegram for Guernica. So I just wondered why you, is that still in the, in, is that still a plan, or are you, that's fallen by the wayside?
Well, it's very interesting you should link it back to that book, Telegram from Guernica, which was the life of the war correspondent, George Steer. Now, George Steer was a fascinating character, a South African-born Wickhamist who was on the side of small nations, Ethiopia first, then the Basques, and then the Finns, but particularly the Basque country. And he was the man who reported the bombing of Guernica in the Times and the New York Times, probably the most important dispatch of the Second World War. But what's interesting about Steer is that he knew that as a journalist, he said, the journalist is the historian of every day. And as the historian must be wedded to the truth, so must the journalist, with the power that he wields, see that the truth prevails. So Steer was a man totally interested in truth. And this thing of history, journalism, and truth is really important. I'm not really a historian in the sense of a trained academic historian. I didn't read history at university. I did history A level. But, you know, I became a kind of a storyteller and a journalist. The instinct of the journalist, some of the best historians are like journalists. A woman like Barbara Tuchman, for example, one of my favorite historians. Here's a woman who goes and walks the battlefields, who sees the details. She has the journalist's eye for detail. This enlivens history. It's not merely theory like German history, but it's the detailed eye. Now, the thing about Steer was, he was on the side of the Basques, and he remained involved with them. And what I wanted to do was tell the other side of what happened to the Basques after the fall of Euskadi, the Basque Republic, and what happened to them in the Second World War. And it's a very interesting story, because they remained Democrats. They were on the side of the Allies, and Franco, Spain were on the side of the Axis. I mean, the place was a sort of semi-Axis power, German and Italian spies. Hitler and Mussolini had helped Franco to power. So I wanted to tell the story of the Basques, and I had a very good, you know, I wrote a long, what's it called?
Proposal?
A proposal. I wrote a good proposal, and it was accepted as part of the two-book contract. First one on Gibraltar, second one on the Basque. But having done 3-4 years on Gibraltar, I couldn't bear to spend any more time with Franco and fascists. And then maybe having to learn Basque, which is, you know,
I was going to ask you,
not an easy language. So what had happened to me was, long ago, Julian Luce had said to me, look, okay, you do these books, you get commissioned to write these war books. And then you can do one for yourself. And I suddenly thought, well, this is the one I want to do for myself. The last chapter of the Gibraltar books talks about the SS Uganda, which was a hospital ship during the Falklands Malvinas War. And I said, I know this ship because I went to Africa on it in 1954. But that's another story I wrote in the book. So actually, the Gibraltar book, I picked up that story and I have written that story in Trapped in History. That's a convoluted way of saying I couldn't bear, it would have been too hard. I still think it's a fascinating story, and one that is well worth telling. Whether I'm the man to write it or not, I don't know.
Well, having read Telegram for Guernica, I would strongly argue that you are, but let's leave that for now and deal with Trapped in History. And actually, I have some listeners from Kenya. You'll be pleased to hear. I checked my map today just to check. And listeners will be familiar with the British Empire around 1923, because a book was recently published by Matthew Parker. And that's a really interesting book on the empire at its largest territorial extent.
Just before the Empire Exhibition, which I mentioned in my book, 1924, the great year of it. Yes, it is. This is the height of the British Empire. It's just on the eve of that. That was its maximum extent. And of course, Kenya, as it was then, became a colony in 1920. So it's part of that extended empire.
It's very interesting because reading that book, you get the sense that the empire And obviously we know this now looking back, but it does just feel it's all over. And now your book opens, you're on the ship heading to Kenya in 1954. And we're very much at the fag end of the empire now, aren't we?
We are, but people still think it's going on. What hasn't really happened is, as I mentioned in the book, as we go out, because by sailing on the book, you're able to tick off the countries that have been occupied by Europeans. You sail past Spanish Morocco, you know, once Italian Libya, you know, French Algeria, you know, all these nations have had bits of it. And they were, in 1954, still largely ruled by Europeans. The Mau Mau uprising was, according to Ngugi wa Thiong'o, and he's right, the first armed uprising against colonialism. There'd been resistance to imperialism in the earlier stages. But this is before Algeria. This is before Zimbabwe, before Mozambique, before all the African revolutions. So in 54, there was still people still, there were still jobs. There was still a colonial office. It was around this time in 54 that it all began to change, and people began to see the writing on the wall. And by 1960, and Harold Macmillan's "The Wind of Change is Blowing Through Africa," the jig was up. But in the early 50s, it was still a going concern, and people thought we could carry on. But basically, the Tories realized we can't have troops east of Suez. We can't maintain this empire. It's gone. Actually, the Second World War destroyed it. The way I see the Second World War is that none of this Britain stood alone stuff in 1940. They didn't. At their back, they had this enormous empire. And the empire came together, and the colonies. You know, West Indians gave money to buy Spitfires. You know, people from Newfoundland and Canada and Antigua and West Africa and South Africa and East Africa and India and Ceylon and Pakistan and New Zealand and Australia. Oh, and India provided millions of soldiers. All of them came together to defeat fascism. But the quid pro quo of this was, when this is over, we're off, you know? So the fireworks go up and the sticks come clattering down, and by and large, decolonization happens. First it goes Burma, and then there's Jordan and all the rest of it, Ghana. And so the process of decolonization was inevitable after the war, but people thought they could stop it. You know, Ian Smith declared UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, in 1964, still thinking that whites could rule. The South Africans held out for a long time. The Portuguese in Mozambique, they could not see really the writing on the wall. So you either go with this flow. You might resist it. You might think it's all wrong. But that is the destiny. That is the wind of change. It's going to happen. All those empires left eventually.
And so when you arrive in Kenya, though, in 54, I mean, you don't remember it. You're only four, I think.
Well, I was three when I arrived, and I had my fourth birthday within about 3 weeks of arriving. Now, of course, I'm not saying that I came with my quill and my pen and my three-year-old mentality to write things down, but I was there till I was 13. My 13th birthday was there. And you can remember things between 4 and 13. So largely, it's drawn from that. And then I drew up.
Sorry to interrupt you. I've been just finished reading. I have to mention this because I'll forget otherwise. I've just been reading about you melting lead and pouring to make stained glass windows. Health and safety was not a significant factor in those days. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
Those memories, because what I describe is going to my first school, Togoni Day School, and an important area. We lived Kiambu, Limuru, Kiambu County now, which is on the edge of what was called the Kikuyu Reserve, because his areas were divided. And since the Kikuyu, Meru and Embu, particularly the Kikuyu, were the instigators and leaders and main participants in the Mau Mau uprising, this is close to, in American Westerns, this is close to Indian country, as you might say, as Americans would describe it. But my prep school was down in the Rift Valley, and it was a place called Pembroke House, and I describe it. It was founded in 1928. And it was you'd given a certain amount of freedom. And the schoolboys built the school chapel. This is, you know, stonemasonry work, working at height, and we were working with lead. I mean, I'm laughing now. My wife's horrified. There's no supervision. We're melting lead from old car batteries, pouring it into molds, which were then bent into these rods. And the stained glass was smashed bottles. Now, believe me, in Kenya Colony, there was no shortage of alcoholic beverages. Lots of green from the gin bottles, you know, blue from milk of magnesia bottles. But, you know, we're looking for red and stuff, but loads of beer bottles and wine bottles. And it was an adventurous school in many ways. We had khaki bush jackets, but there are other stories, bad sides of that too. But I try to set my own story within a much wider history.
Let's get to it really, because I was saying before we started recording, I'm aware of the Mau Mau uprising, a particularly nasty counterinsurgency involving horrific killings on both sides. But that was the extent of my knowledge before starting the book. And so, just for the listener's sake, really, who were the Mau Mau and why does the uprising begin? Which I think it begins in 52, just before you arrived.
The emergency, as it was called, lasted from 52 to 1960. But as the title explains, trapped in history, the point of the book is that things don't just begin ab ovo straight like that. It comes out of a situation. One man, a friend of mine, a scholar in America who read this book, said, well, once you read the first 200 pages, all the rest makes sense. It's kind of inevitable. And the first 200 pages are the history, really, of European, the scramble for Africa, the colonization of Africa, that here was a continent, not on the fringes, but in the center, had had no contact with the outside world. In Kenya, inland from Kenya, the people couldn't read or write, did not have the wheel. They lived, you know, as pastoralists, agriculturalists, as honey gatherers or whatever. They lived their own life. But now, in the Victorian age, they're in contact with people with rifles, you know, telephones, machine guns, steam power. Here is, as Robert Louis Stevenson saw with the Polynesian islanders, they were like sort of pots of china, you know, being on the tide of history, being knocked down by iron ships. How can a continent resist such power? And all the colonizers drove their railways in and they started to exploit the minerals, the resources, the riches of Africa. And you could say it's gone on ever since. Well, what happens is that you end up in the 1950s with, in Kenya, a pyramid of dominance. You have 50,000 Europeans, white people, over 200,000, quarter of a million brown people, Asians, and on top of 5 million Africans, black people. Now, how can 50,000 white people expect to dominate 5 million black people who are now learning to read and write and to think and see how the rest of the world is? It's not going to work. And this pyramid of dominance you could see as a kind of volcano. Now, if the volcano is bubbling, the magma is bubbling, there have to be ways for it to escape. Now, if legitimate constitutional means aren't really allowed, if the educated Africans like Peter Koinange or Jomo Kenyatta himself cannot get places in the government, there is no way for these people forward, and they struggle and they do their best, then the hot-headed young ones, the radicals, the disaffected youth and people who were in the Second World War army and think, well, I've got nothing. These people have got all of them. I've got nothing. And, you know, and they, maybe some of them are criminals and they're, it's bubbling up and it explodes. And it explodes in 1952 with this, I suppose you could describe the Mau Mau. We'll have to come back to what that name means. But it's kind of like a secret society of resistance to European rule, in which people joined by taking an oath to support the cause, not betray each other. And then the hotheads start saying, right, people who don't take the oath, get killed. So murders start, terrorism starts, frightening people into doing this. That's what terrorism is. You do something atrocious in order to frighten people into doing things. Take ISIS. Okay, let's take a modern example. ISIS televising appalling atrocities to frighten people into obedience or compliance with their wish for this caliphate and their abuse of people who didn't join. Not all the Mau Mau were like that, but many were at the beginning. This was a at the same time, of course, there are other Africans who were constitutional nationalists, because you can see the whole movement of African nationalism. And this is what I describe in the book, really, through the life of Jomo Kenyatta, who becomes the first prime minister and the first president. The rise of African nationalism, perfectly legitimate. Look, we are the majority here. We want to be in charge of our own country. Now, any decent ruling system has to somehow adapt to that, has to allow it, because it wasn't allowed. I'll give you another example. Let's go back to the Basques. Why did ETA arise? ETA arose, and what does ETA mean? Euskadi ta askatasuna, Basque homeland and freedom, land and freedom. What were the Mau Mau? Kenya Land and Freedom Army. Before ETA, land and freedom. These are very often what we call terrorist movements or guerrilla movements or upsurges, insurgencies, banditries. If you look at Eric Hobsbawm and these people, many of these movements are about land and they're about people's idea of freedom. Now, there are constitutional, decent ways to try and get freedom, but if these are blocked, hotheads and violent people and thugs and sometimes psychopaths who think this is great, war brings out the best and the worst in people. Some people are good and noble and brave. Others want to kill and maim people. This has always gone on. Our side, their side, anybody's side. War is horrible. But there were constitutional nationalists who wanted a legitimate way through, and they were kind of thwarted. And at the same time, there were conservative Africans who saw, look, we're Christians now, and we're going to follow the white man's way and work for the government, and we're going to get education. And so what happens is that you also get a kind of civil war within Kenya between different African beliefs of what is the right way forward. I will give you an example from India, Second World War. You had plenty of Indians who fought for the British Empire, thinking that, well, if we do this, we will get our freedom. And there were other Indians who joined the Indian Nationalist Army fighting for the Japanese against the British. Now, which of them is correct? Who, you know, these are the complexities of history. I've got a chapter in the book called The Hero and the Traitor, drawn from Borges. But it's really how you see this person. Who is truly the patriot here? What is patriotism? Is it to something small and local, or is it something greater? What do you have to do to achieve this? How are you forced to behave? And I think in every conflict, and in every insurgency, you will have this. There are the loyalists. They traitors. They may be loyal for Christian decent reasons, not bad reasons. But the other people, nationalists, the American rebels, or whatever you want to call it, say the American Revolution.
It's complicated. Just drilling into that a little bit more in the case of Kenya, I mean, it's not described as a war of independence. I guess
It's seen that way now. And this is the point about this.
But it's a lot more complicated than that, isn't it?
Yes. You see, this is what one of the things about the trapped in history, and in the early chapter two, is a brief discussion of history in the sense that there are self-serving versions of history. Histories are stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And we have self-glorifying stories. Now, let us take Brexit. You talk to a Brexiteer and you talk to a non-Brexiteer, and they all have different versions of history, okay? There's a kind of plucky, noble Britain standing on its own against the Luftwaffe and foreign courts, as I heard on the radio today, courts which we set up and used to belong to, but now called foreign courts. So, and then there are those who believe in European civilization and think that this is a greater thing to belong to. Each tells a different history.
And each projects onto the other side as well.
And then you demonize the other side because they are wrong and we are right. That is fake news, or that is wrong, or that is treacherous. What I tell you, on the first page of the book, it's an empire book, and I say all empire stories are mixed messages, okay, in which, I don't know, love and cruelty, you know, beauty and horror are all intermingled. There's no pure story out of empire. It just isn't pure. And all the writers recognize this. And Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, I remember hearing him interviewed, and he said, it's a zigzag. It's never a straight line, you know, and it's never simple. Obviously, for propaganda purposes, people want a simple story, a goodies and baddies. There's an evil empire and there's a good empire. Well, it's never like that.
You can't generalize about empire, can you?
No, that's why the journalistic instinct to get down into the grain of the detail, to find the stories, the anecdotes, the poignancies of it, because it often is poignant. I mean, the story of Jomo Kenyatta, which in a sense, this is a kind of sort of light biography of him. He goes through various identities and names. I mean, he's born Kamau Ngengi, and he's a herd boy. He's illiterate. He's just an ordinary Kikuyu boy in a blanket. Okay. Then he becomes a Christian, learns to read and write. And he wanted to call himself John Peter Kamau. But they wouldn't allow two names because you can only have one name. So he chose the name Johnston, which is John and Stone, Petrus, Peter, Stone. So he became Johnston Kamau or J.N. Kamau, Johnston Ngengi Kamau. And then when he went down to the Maasai country, he started wearing a beaded belt, which in Maasai is a Kenyatta. So he changed his name to Johnston Kenyatta. And then in the 1930s, with his friend Peter Mbuyu Koinange, they thought, no, Johnston, we need an African-sounding name. And they sat down in a room, they played with what was euphonically best, and they came up with an authentically African name, Jomo Kenyatta. So Jomo is more, but it's all, his original name has gone. And he's gone, there's four different identities as he in different parties, and he ends as the president, dictator for life, essentially. And so in a way, he's a heroic figure, but there's also a kind of tragedy in that, as observed by the great Peter Abrahams, who's one of the writers that I admire and mention in the book, who knew Kenyatta before in exile and then back in Africa. So the identity changes. It's never a straight heroic story. There are poignancies, there are losses, there are things that go wrong. History is very often tragedy when it's not farce.
Yeah, completely agreed on that. For the uninitiated, Kenya's created sort of East Africa by the British, isn't it, effectively?
Well.
But it's constituted of a lot of different groups of people.
Yeah, I mean, its own history is very interesting and mixed. When the first European explorers went into Kenya, as it was then, but part of British East Africa, there's a desert behind the coastland, which stopped a lot of people going through. So no one had really been into the interior, except a few Arab traders. So there were missionaries who'd spotted snow-capped mountains inside. So it's not just desert, there's snowy mountains in there. And when they first went through, they came across all kinds of different peoples, as there were. There's something like between 25 and 30 different language groups and peoples, you know. Now, we call them tribes. Now, people get anxious about the word tribe, saying, you know, it's a colonial word, you can't use it. But people know, and it's still there in Kenya now, people will know who is a Luo and who is a Kikuyu and you know, who is Nandi and possibly where they're from. And there are old jokes about them and differences between them. But essentially, you have people who are sometimes at war, sometimes intermarry, but there's a turbulence between them. They've got different lifestyles and they inhabit different ecological niches. There are people who live in the desert, the Samburu, and people that nobody else would want to live in. A lot of Kenya is desert, quite dry, and the highlands, because I mean, if we look at geography here, you have the Rift Valley that runs all the way from Palestine down to Zimbabwe. And in the middle, you have rainforest, and it splits the forest. And you had two different kinds of, apes on that side, as it were, and hominins emerged on that side. So the bonobo and gorillas and chimpanzees are over there. But on the eastern side, you get another kind of ape that emerges into various kinds of hominin. Mankind begins over there in Eastern Africa. This is where we all come from. One of the things I mentioned about Hugh Trevor Roper, a historian I admire greatly, but he wrote in his Rise of Christian Europe one of the most absurd sentences ever written by the Regius Professor of History at Oxford, when he said that there is no history in Africa except the history of the Europeans, which is patently absurd, as Roland Oliver pointed out. He said, we all came out of Africa, including the ancestors of the Trevor Ropers. I mean, they had just written that very year a history of Africa that went back 20 million years in Africa. So you can't deny African history at all. It may not be understood and it may not be studied, but it's there. Anyway, to go back to
Well,
was.
we were talking. Okay, so there was one is what are the different groups of
Okay,
people?
in East Africa,
What
they
is
went through, now, there were
Kenya? Yeah.
all these different tribes, but the point is that the imperial principle, when you go into a country, you follow the Romans. When the Romans, for example, went into Gaul, Julius Caesar killed 1 million people. This needs to be remembered. He killed 1 million people when they came to England. Okay, he already had some people who were allies, and they helped because the Roman rule is divide et impera, divide and conquer. So what you do is you get one tribe and set them against another. The Spanish did this when they went to Mexico. You find one tribe. The Mongols did this. What you do is you find a tribe lower down the pecking order, say, okay, you get the power now. Go and bash up all the people who used to exploit you, but you do it for us. So the British used the Maasai against the Kikuyu. I mean, there's a whole list of all the rebellions that were put down by the British in the conquering phase. And conquering was certainly over by the First World War. And therefore, the British would say, we are pacifying people in order to civilize them. We're going to bring them, Christianity and the benefits of civilization. And they do. They bring medicine. They bring order. They stop the fighting. And then, of course, people start procreating more, population increases because you've got medicine and people aren't dying and there isn't internecine warfare. Some will get educated, not enough. The British had a very weird policy on language. The French taught all their imperial subjects French, but the British didn't. And weirdly, in Kenya, instead of imposing English on everybody, they imposed a coastal trading language called Kiswahili, which was a sort of it was the coastal language, but with Arabic and Persian words in it. And this was then used as the lingua franca of all the different other tribes. So a Kikuyu speaking to an English woman who he was working for used another language, Swahili, which she didn't speak very well either. She spoke Kisetla or kitchen Swahili.
And
So a
did you
sort of
speak that when you were
pidgin.
there?
Well, of course, we picked it up, picked up phrases and spoke it, but not fluently. I didn't, certainly. But yes, I mean, there was a currency, and their words entered into our language. You haven't got to the end of the book yet, but the book ends with a short story, the first short story I ever wrote. And there's a word in there, nyonga. Somebody's been nyongered by the mama. Nyonga means to kill. It's the only time it appears in the book, but that was a word we used as schoolboys, nyonga. And there were all kinds of South African and African words that came into our language, our little idiolect. What you have is then you have a colonial superstructure on top, administrators, of district officers, district commissioners, things like this. And then you have many, many good people who come and do things like forestry and agronomy and medicine. I mean, this idea of sort of people with curly moustaches, whipping people, and it's all brutal exploitation. There are a lot of dedicated people in the colonial services, vets. I mean, the vets aren't there to torture the animals. They're helping people to farm better. So you have And a lot of the farmers too, they're trying to develop new kind of crops. They're trying to work out why are the sheep dying? And then they suddenly discover there's the wrong minerals in the soil, so you need to put these minerals in. The country is also being developed, not just exploited. And this is the complexity of empire. I heard a Maasai the other day on Kenyan television saying, and this was, it was very good to hear, because I mean, literally it was 2 weeks ago, saying, he said, well, he said, you know, when you think about it, he said, the British left the country in a better state than they found it. Okay, he's comparing 1963 with 1893. And there's no doubt they did leave it in a better state with roads and factories and all sorts of things. Yes, terrible things happened, and we should go into all that. But the complexity of history is that good and bad are intermingled.
So the uprising itself then?
Mau Mau was a term that the Africans themselves did not use. Kenyatta in his trial said, this is not a word we know. But it's probably, and this was attested by some of the earliest writers on the Mau Mau phenomenon, that it came probably from this word Muma, meaning oath. Now, someone could mishear this, a Nandi person, and tell his officer, they said, this Muma is to do with this. And the Muma was the oath. And oathing, when I was a boy, was considered this terrible thing, that to join this secret society, you had to do disgusting things, obscene things, which were painted by the British as somehow satanic and bestial and disgusting and revolting and couldn't be written about in the newspapers. So the propaganda image of the Mau Mau was of terrifying African savagery and primitivism and possibly black magic. When we were children, we used to read all kinds of comics and stuff. And I remember out of West Africa, the thing that was terrifying out of West Africa were the leopard men. Now, the leopard men of West Africa were, again, a kind of secret society who either could turn into leopards or pretended to be leopards and scared people, you know, with the power of the leopard. And the Mau Mau had a sort of frightening image in that they attacked or killed people who wouldn't join. And this is where we get into the horrors and stuff. But in East Africa, the agricultural country, most people are growing their own crops. They're, you know, people are working on farms. The commonest implement would be called in South America machete. In Malay, it would be called a parang. In the West Indies, it would be a cutlass. But in Kenya and East Africa, it's called a panga. Many of the best of these were made by a company called Martindale in England. In fact, they're basically a heavy bladed tool for agricultural purposes. You could chop through bamboo, whittle and things. But when you use this on people, it has the effect of the gladius, the Roman short sword. You know, inflicting traumatic blunt force injuries. And so killings with these and stranglings and things like this, mutilation of bodies and stuff, had a sort of terrifying effect. And then therefore the government in its depiction of the Mau Mau emphasized all this. Mutilation of animals, hawking, disemboweling, and chopping people up and stuff. So this was the image of it. Now, not many Europeans were killed by the Mau Mau, 32 sort of murdered by them. But what happened was that there was the ones who went into the forest, the Itungati, the guerrillas of the forest, called themselves the Kenya Land Freedom Army. And they were a guerrilla army up in the forest, and they came out to fight the police and the soldiers and to raid shambas and get food from the villages. And this was a very different thing. They were an armed force. And there were savage battles against the home guard, because the British started using other Kikuyu to defend the villages and to fight against them. And most of the Mau Mau who were killed by other Africans, by the home guard. And the Mau Mau said, the home guard are all rapists and thieves and all the rest of it. So they hate each other, but they speak the same language. Now, the complexity of the book is that if you're a villager and these armed men come to you at night, dreadlocks, and threaten you, well, you're going to do what they say. And then in the day, men come in, you know, British uniforms, and they're just as violent, and they want you to do something, you're going to do that. So most people were loyalist and Mau Mau. You know, the fact is, how are you going to survive with armed people around you? You have to switch codes. You have to switch modes. And people did that. It's not, again, all this. It depends on the circumstances. What are you going to do if you're threatened? Your children, your wife is threatened. And you know people are capable of murder one way or the other. These are the tragedies, you know? The uprising starts really after, and this is what the chronology of the book shows. Essentially, what the British forces did was they got very frightened of African nationalism, and they decided that the Mau Mau, this secret society, was being run by KAU, the Kenya African Union, so the political party. So what they did was they imposed emergency measures, and they thought they'd decapitate the legitimate political party KAU. By arresting all the leaders of that, you would stop Mau Mau. But they weren't the leaders of Mau Mau. So you arrest a group of people, including Jomo Kenyatta. There's a famous trial, this, the Kapunguria Six. If you go to Kenya, there's a new museum, the Ujamaa Museum, and you will see there's a whole section on the Kapunguria Six. And it was a show trial of six political leaders accused of running a secret society, you know, fermenting disorder. And it was a show trial. They were found guilty. They were all locked up. But that didn't stop the Mau Mau. And the new repressive measures forced more people into the forest, and therefore the violence got worse. So it's partly the way that you try to repress something happening can have worse consequences. You're not quelling the flames, you're putting petrol on the flames.
This is a classic example of a, well, it ultimately was a successful counterinsurgency, yeah. I suppose, militarily. But I mean, I've interviewed Petraeus, who ran counterinsurgencies in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he seems to have largely learned from many errors before that. But you mentioned Algeria, there's Indochina, Malaya, you can argue was a bit more successful. But these are just classic examples of boots on the ground getting it wrong. What we never seem to...
You throw troops, white... Let's say the point was the colonial government had its police forces, it had its special branch, it had soldiers out there, but they also rotated in British Army troops from England. Do not speak the language, speak no African language at all. Cannot tell one person from another. I've seen British soldiers when they were dumped in the Balkans. Who the hell are these people? I mean, how do you work out who's who? It was the same in 69 in the Troubles. I mean, they all look identical. Which is it, Protestant? Is it Catholic? Who's who? And then in the Balkans, are they this? Are they that? Are they Croats? Who are Serbs? I mean, which one's the good one? Which one's the bad one? Who's actually the enemy here? It's exactly the same in these colonial wars. So you end up with a situation, essentially a racist situation. Well, everybody blacks the enemy except our soldiers who are fighting for us. I don't know who these people are. And they couldn't tell the difference between civilians and combatants. So innocent people get swept up. Okay, you belong to this language group. Well, you've probably taken an oath. We're going to detain you. And what happens is you get this detention system, the pipeline, as it's called, right about it in the book, and thousands of people are detained, and then they are screened to see if they're loyal or not. And, you know, in these interrogations, there's torture and thousands of people locked up. And, well, this is it. And then there are terrible incidents like the Hola massacre, where a lot of prisoners are beaten to death. 11 prisoners are beaten to death. And this gets into Parliament. There's a huge row in Parliament. People, this is absolutely appalling. What are we doing? The countries are moving towards independence. And a new Conservative government says, look, for goodness sake, the jig's up. And you end the emergency and say, okay, we're going towards independence. And then you start having conferences, political conferences, to move. Because you've won the war, because the emergency was really effectively over by 56 with the death of Kamathi. but you've now got to make the peace. It's exactly the same in Northern Ireland. The British government could not let the IRA win, but you have to get them to a stalemate position where you can have the Good Friday Agreement. The British aren't going to let them win, but they will see. Philip Mason, who's one of the writers I write about in the book, picked up an idea from a French anthropologist called Oliver Mononi, the Prospero complex. Now, Prospero is the central character in The Tempest, the last play by Shakespeare, which is really about colonialism, because it's about a white man going to an island, finding two kinds of people who live there, Caliban and Ariel, and he gets them as his servants. And then by his magic, his rough magic, he manipulates all the rest of the plots. But at the end of it, he has to give it up. And who gets the island? This is what's so interesting. It's not Ariel, the loyal servant. It's Caliban, okay? The one who, the bad one, as it were, becomes. So that's what Jomo Kenyatta was. He was Caliban to Prospero until they realized, oh my goodness, we're going to have to go. Who is the person that everybody wants? We've locked him up for 9 years. We've called him leader unto darkness and death. But they all look up to him as the leader. So we'll change the system and he will go into the government, take head of constitutional affairs, and then become, after the first election, the first prime minister and then the president. And Prospero leaves, Caliban takes over the island.
So this is the Colonial Office.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask about the colonizers in Kenya at the time.
Okay. Nobody thinks of themselves as a colonizer like this. I mean, it's interesting, the discourse now. There's a huge amount about, you know.
Exactly. I'm using that because it's become.
People talk about Israel and all this as colonizers and stuff that people somehow. Let's go back to Kenya. But there were people there.
Yeah, I think Middle East.
Who had lived there for many years. Or they had been born there. They were white Africans. They hadn't come in. These people had worked on these farms. They were invited there by the British government after the First World War. They were invited. They didn't go out there and kill people. The British government said, look, we've built this railway. We need people. There's land here. You want land? You were a soldier? Come and get it. So they went. And they cleared this land. And they worked this land. And they sweated on it, and their children were brought up there, and maybe their grandchildren, and they felt, this is ours, we've been here. And also those people, those colonial servants that I mentioned before, the agronomists, the veterinarians, the forestry people, the doctors, you know, what are you saying? They're colonizers because they're actually trying to help people make things better. They're trying to grow and develop the country. It can't be seen as just wicked exploitation. It's too simple.
And I don't think I meant it by that word, but they are connected.
But they don't see themselves as a sense as colonizers. They say, look, we have earned this. We have worked this. We have employed people. We have not exploited people. This is for everybody here. And there's a marvelous bit in the book. I think it's marvelous because it's a moment just before independence. So it's actually 60 years ago in 1963, in August 1963, there were a lot of these farmers, you know, leathery old jug-eared men with, you know, tanned faces and white necks underneath, who thought, what's going to happen now? The Africans are going to take it, it's going to black government, self-rule. What's going to happen to us? And Jomo Kenyatta, who'd been in jail, seen as this great leader of Mau Mau, came to talk to this meeting of settlers at Nakuru. Now, in the chair was the grandson of Lord Delamere. Lord Delamere is a huge figure in the history of Kenya. You know, aristocrat, came out there, vast amount of land, developed a lot of it, but he was a sort of old school leader of the settlers. His grandson is chairing this baraza, this meeting in Nakuru, and they're sitting there, you know, gloomy, thinking, well, okay, what's he going to say to us? Kenyatta comes out and he says, now when Kenyatta came back to Kikuyu, he got his own land at Gatundu. He said, look, I can't live on other people's land. I must be like every other Kikuyu, but I've got to have my own land. So he had his own land. He grew his own crops as he had done in England, in Storrington, when he lived in England during the war. 15 years, he grew Mahindi, he grew maize, you know, and poured libations, Kikuyu style, by a willow tree and stuff. So he was a man of the earth. And he said to these people, look, we're all children of the soil. You and me, we're both farmers, okay? And we love this land. And then he said, look, there's one thing we can do for each other. We are all humans. None of us are angels. White, brown, or black. We are humans. We are not angels. And we are bound to make mistakes. We've done things wrong. But there's one thing we can do, he said. We can forgive each other. If I have done you wrong, it is for you to forgive me. If you have done me wrong, it is for me to forgive you. Let us forgive each other, he said. And then we can all, white, brown, and black, make this a great nation. And a lot of those men thought, it's going to be okay. Mzee, as they called him, the old man, he's going to take over, but he's all right. And many of them stayed, and they have done. And you have a kind of mixed economy.
Today,
I didn't
yeah.
Your earlier question about the fact that of the groups making up Kenya, there were the whites and there were many kinds of African as well, but there were also the Asians. There was a huge middle class from India and Pakistan. And, you know, the Ugandan and the Kenyan Asians that came over when Africanization happened in the 60s, who came, they changed this country. They were a big part of the story of Kenya too. So you have different races, if you want to use that word, but people with different cultures, different backgrounds, different skin colors. It is a mixed nation. How are you going to get on together? Are you going to kill each other? Or are you going to work together? Same with us here. Somebody, the man wrote a book called This Is Not America. I haven't read his book. Tommy Owolade.
Yeah, he's an interesting writer.
Yeah, I mean, but his point is a good one. I mean, I instantly you understand this. People start saying this is like America. It's not like America. It's a different history.
Absolutely.
And so anyway, the point is that there's a moment of hope there. There's a moment of, because that's what we've got to look for. The story is a horrible one in many ways, entrapped in history. But at the same time, we have to get through it. The point is the book, the quote comes from James Baldwin. These people are trapped in a history which if they do not understand, they cannot be free from. He was talking about, I think, white people in America who didn't understand the genocide of the Indians and the historic slavery. Now, they don't want that position. Maybe, you know, they're a nice liberal person. They don't want the idea of slavery, but they have to live with the consequences. It's there. They are trapped in history, as we are trapped in our imperial history and our ideas of superiority to everybody else on the planet. God, of course, is an Englishman, as we know.
Yeah, it's interesting that I was going to ask you in the context of Kenya, of course, but when we look at empire, how, because we're still, it's the relatively recent past when
very,
or, I mean, you know, there's still little outposts now.
Well, okay, they call them outposts. I mean, this is another thing that annoys me.
People talk
about Gibraltar as a colony, for example, and they try to use decolonization. The Spanish have got the Latin Americans to say it's as though there are sort of mustachio twirling Victorians, you know, ruling over the Spanish. It's not a colony any more than the Argentines were amazed when they invaded the Falkland Islands to discover people weren't. They lived there. They belonged there. So the Falklands, Gibraltar, they are not colonies in the exploited sense that have to be liberated. They are people who live there, have lived there for generations. And Gibraltar is a fantastically, wonderfully mixed place. And, you know, I support that they are a nation now. They may be very small and they should be supported. And I find the indifference to Gibraltar in this country astonishing.
Well, it was because, you know, empire is hugely topical at the moment. Colonization, all this kind of stuff. And I wondered your view, you know, you said at the start that you don't view yourself necessarily as a historian, more a kind of, I don't know, a journalist of history, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. I do journalism of the past, as it were.
Yeah, journalism of the past. But I just wondered, because, you know, the empire is a recent, relatively recent thing that's now, you know, it's over. Do you think we're at the right stage?
Yes, we have to look back at our own. But the thing about this is that What happens with English-speaking peoples, and this is one of the things I keep saying, is the great relic of the British Empire is the English language. It's a world language because of the British Empire. The Americans were part of the first British Empire. The Indians were part of the British Empire. So English is a world language on which people argue ferociously about how terrible the British Empire was in English. I always find that an irony. But the fact is that the British Empire is one among many. And the history of the world is the history of empires. The fact is, we live in an age of empire now, the Russian Empire, the Chinese Empire, they may not say so, but they're Belt and Road. It's a kind of imperialism. The American Empire. I mean, before that, you go through the whole of Africa, you know, the Dutch, the Italian Empire, the French Empire, the Spanish Empire. But other cultures, it's not just Europeans. I have a book called The Comanche Empire, okay? You could talk about the Zulu Empire,
the Mongol
Empire. The history of the world is empires. And they rise and they fall. The history of nature is linked to imperialism too. I mean, it's not just the empire of the shark and the robin's plucky canton from Auden. I mean that if you look at plants, plants will expand until they meet, they run out of resources or they meet a predator or they can't do it. You know, you could see it is in the nature of living things to expand and move out. It's part of nature. How come the British, this tiny little island, okay, or the Dutch, you know, that suddenly should sprout and go out and send these people out, and then they shrink back, they become nothing. The Portuguese, they're tiny now. They had the first European global empire. They were enslaving people as far away as Korea and Japan, as well as down in Brazil and all the rest of it. They're nothing now, and we will become like that too. The Italians. You know, great people. I mean, me piace molto italiani, but, you know, if they're the descendants of the Roman Empire, you know, it shrinks. It's expand and contract. And this is always the case. Ibn Khaldun, the great Arab historian, said there are the three phases. And this is true of dynasties, of families, and of empires. You have the founders, the initial people who go out and conquer and do things and amazing. Then you have the consolidators, and they build it and expand it and do this and they do that. But in the end, the third phase is always there. Comes that terrible generation in the family or the end of a dynasty or the end of an empire, the destroyers. So you have the founders, the consolidators, and then the destroyers. And that empire will end. That dynasty will fall. That family will descend and be like everyone else. That is the nature of history.
Yep, and then another one rises.
Yeah, another one's arising.
Now, this has been a fantastic, important piece of context at the end there. Thank you.
My pleasure, Rob.
Thanks so much for listening. As ever, please do get in touch if you've got any questions or comments. Plenty more great history to come, but until then, thank you and good night.